Hi, this is Terry Kojima here at Penn State University. And what we would like to discuss today is DNA and protein analysis using nanotechnology. And this is part two in our series. So what we've looked at so far is we took a basic look at some issues with, we took a look at some applications of microarrays and why they're necessary. And then we're also looking at microfluidics and some basic physics, you know, what makes microfluidics special compared to everyday world. So there's some constraints that we have to look at, and naturally we have to devise and look at manufacture our materials to match those constraints. So today what we're going to do is look at common materials and processes. So there's common materials that we would use all the time for nanotechnology, and often what people like to use is SiO2. SiO2 is relatively inert. It's relatively inexpensive per se compared to a lot of materials. Etching machinery is well known. We have wet etching, and we also have dry etching at the per se the nanoscale. So they use it quite a bit in microelectronics. So we can, borrow their technology and move it into the microfluidic regime. And we also use quite a bit metals because, you know, the attributes of metals for additive and subtractive processes. And here's some looks at some applications, what microfluidic devices look like that people commonly make. We also can use polymers because we could use those and certainly take advantage of the physical deformation and shaping necessary. And another material that's quite often used is paper. It's a substrate used for fluidic flow because it actually has capillary action associated with it. So we can buy different specific papers for microfluidics, and they have engineered capillary action due to their structure. So we can take a look at these fluidic flows right here, or fluidic systems right here, based on polymers and metals and silicon dioxide and papers. So common materials, we like to use SiO2 because we can do precision plasma etching or chemical etching. Generally, those processes tend to be moderately expensive and dangerous, though. Or they not dangerous that, you know, things are going to be wrong, but they're expensive because we have to take care of using the materials, etch materials such as hydrofluoric acid, etc. Those tend to be dangerous if not disposed of appropriately. But when they're perfectly used, they're not dangerous. It's just that we have to have concern for the danger. Metals, we can use those quite a bit and make sacrificial layers, etc. They tend to be expensive and complex. Polymers tend to be good for photopatterning, molding, and embossing. They tend to be, like a lot of products, polymers tend to be inexpensive and easy to mass produce. And paper is probably the forefront of microfluidic technology. I don't know to say that or to be the judge of that, but we can use paper for either active or passive results. It's generally inexpensive, and we have built into it the ability to flow material. But compared to conventional microfluidic devices based on like silicon technology, they tend to be a little bit slower in their determination of a procedure. So again, here's some common polymer materials that we use. PMMA, polymethyl methacrylate, is common. PDMS is also common. So PMMA is analogous to something that would be like a glue epoxy, kind of like super glue or airplane glue. PDMS is a material, a silicon-based material that is similar to bathtub caulking silicones. So it's a rubber-like material. We also can use polyamides, and then SU8 is a photoactive material that is not only used as a photoresist, but it's mechanically really robust and durable. So often people use it as a final product. So that's a moderately unusual use for a photoresist, to use it inside a product or use it as a template. So often we could do something like the lower right hand picture. We could make a template like that out of SU8 And then what we can do is pour in PDMS and then keep on pouring the peeling the PDMFs off when we cure it, and then use that original SU8 design as our template. So PDMS is a very good material. I really like PDMS and its use. It occurs in the literature quite often. PDMS is non-toxic. It's optically transparent, and its surface is easily modified. It's naturally hydrophobic, but in an oxygen plasma, we can make it hydrophilic and increase the bonds on the surface area. It's used for fluid flow, and certainly it's used to make a microfluidic side of a chip. And we would immerse it in an oxygen plasma, and then we could take that PDMS and stick it directly to like an SiO2 template on the other side. So it could be one half of our microfluidic design, and it generally tends to be like the three-dimensional area, and that would give us the conduits to where our fluid is flowing through. And our other side, which would typically be a silicon or silicon dioxide substrate, that could be thought of as a two-dimensional layer, which would have like probes on it and a circuitry, et cetera, and valves. So that would be like our 2D kind of stuff. So we can see here, really a thing that people highly admire in biomaterials is we can change the hydrophobicity at will through an oxygen plasma. Other common materials are PMMA. It's a thermoplastic used for molding, and it's opaque to UV light. We can also use polyamides, which are a thermoset, and they're often used in MEMS for high strength and dielectric strength and heat resistance, and they can also be photopatterned. And we already discussed SU8 and PDMS. So this is a nice table to look at cost and optical transparency of these materials. So generally, for the most part, these materials tend to be optically transparent, especially to some spectrums. And this gives us the common materials. That's why this is a link in here. The common companies that make this and the cost, what they are. So some of these are expensive polyamides, $2,000 per kilogram, compared to PMMA, which is $2 a kilogram. You know, and I guess PDMS is on the same scale as PDMA, but we can have like SU8, which is quite expensive too, but certainly not as expensive as polyamides. But within the nano world, because we use so little of this stuff, it is moderately expensive because our devices really don't use that much material. So a kilogram compared to the average size of a lab on a chip, that order of magnitude is quite different. So here's a nice system that's used, developed by a gentleman in Colorado, I believe. And this is a pulsed amperemeric detection system. And basically what they do is they take a material, a liquid material, and they're able to apply a voltage, and that voltage, what it's going to do is change the ionic concentration of the material. And then what they do is they measure that change in conductivity of the material. So it's interesting that the bias is going to change the resistance, and then they measure the resistance. So when they do these pulses, based on the resistance, they can determine material type. So this is a system that can determine carbohydrates, amino acids, and antibiotics. And it's a moderately simple system. And really what's intriguing about it, this particular researcher, Dr. Henry, he started making these devices in the conventional microfluidic world, where we would use a silicon and PDMS substrate combination. And he has since taken the same technology and taken it to, I guess, the next generation of microfluidic device, which uses more paper-driven technology. And the goal to do that is typically this chip that would be based on silicon technology might be a few dollars, as much as lunch cost. But certainly the paper microfluidic device, the goal is that costs much, much less than a cup of tea. So this is the goal here is to make devices in the paper regime for something less than 50 cents. So the pulsed amperemeric detection system, it established electrochemical detector. It uses the established electrochemical detector technology that's found in macro labs. The detector is based on a measurement of current resulting from the oxidation or reduction reaction of the analyte at a suitable electrode. Since the level of current is directly proportional to the analyte concentration, this detector can be used for quantification. So it can be also be used to separate, detect different types of carbohydrates, amino acids, and sulfur-containing antibiotics. And again, this just shows us some more details about the lab on a chip to look at the PAD system and how it contains the integration of the PDMS layer and the two-dimensional layer on there with the gold microelectrodes, etc. So it's, again, a real nice design. And this just shows you what they have to do. They apply this square wave, per se, make the response, and they don't want the sensor to be plated. So basically what they do is they pulse the voltage on there, reactivate it, and then they go to the detection unit and take a look at the detection bias in there. So what they do is they have this different time frame on here to where they do this pulsing and then measurement, pulsing then measurement. And what it does is it keeps the electrodes clean and gives us a valid reading over time. Well, there's another system that I thought that was intriguing. This is a pocket-sized PCR thermocycler, and this was done by Victor Ugas Odon in Texas. And basically what he did is he made a rather simple device, and I like to show this device because it's battery-operated, and we could potentially operate this from a cell phone, per se, with its power, and it shows a U.S. penny on there for a scale. And the temperature controller device, the electronic device, is shown on the bottom right. The power supply, per se, is shown on the top of the diagram. And the microfluidic assembly, heater block assembly, is shown on the left. And what we do in that assembly is we basically take a polymer tube and we put in our DNA material that we want to have the PCR reaction take place. So what we have to do with the DNA PCR reaction, we take the parent DNA and we put it into constituents that could be used to clone the DNA. So basically what this is a DNA cloner, and it has to go through these steps where it anneals, denatures, and does the extension. And basically he has a resistive block on here, and through connections on the resistive block, he has the heater with the batteries there. He changes the screw length, and he's able to change the temperature on here. And through thermocycling, the fluid, hot fluids rise, right? So basically what's going to happen is we have the annealing process go like this. So basically he just moves this through, and then all you have to do in this assembly is replace the tubing with the fluid in there. So this is, I guess you could estimate that this is rather inexpensive to make and modify. And to throw away this piece of polymer tube is certainly inexpensive and appropriate to use. And he's able to do a PCR reaction. So again, from doing PCR reactions, you know, as part of my job or research, it tended to be over the years moderately complex, et cetera, and expensive. But now this gentleman has been able to make this relatively accessible and cheap, and we could see that this might be necessary to do in areas that lack power or infrastructure for scientific method. We could use, you know, simple batteries to do this work. So I thought that was a novel application to share with you. So some other common materials we would take a look at is paper. It could be active or passive, and it's certainly very inexpensive, and it uses the ease of flow, but it generally is slow. So paper-based systems, while we've used them for a long time as litmus paper, you know, for a long time, the first commercial use was through home pregnancy tests, and that occurred in about 1988. Then there was much more demand and interest and research done on that, and patents started to be issued in the 1990s, and then it certainly matured into a more standard technology as it progressed into the year 2000. So basically, it's a technology that could be very, very old, but in the last 30 years, it's grown quite rapidly. So we could use, there's a paper here that you should review again by Dr. Henry out of Colorado. He used the same type of technology or the same application he did before with his silicon-based technology. He actually transferred that to this paper technology. And it's interesting, what he did is he used standard paper, but on the paper where he did not want fluid flow, what he did is he used, in some senses, a printing technique that would clog that paper with wax. So he basically did a printing with an ink that was a wax-based ink, and that would define his pattern of fluidic flow. So where the ink and the wax did not exist, he would have fluidic flow. And this really is a nice way of doing it. Another thing that they do to control the fluidic flow, in addition to certainly the dimensions on the substrate, they take plastic paper, that oversheet, and you can apply that to either side of the paper. And depending on how you cure that heat of that sheet, you can actually put pressure on the paper. So that actually also is an aid to controlling flow. So that's another tool that people use. And this shows you the paper-based system. And I can, you know, you have the link there that you can take a look at and read this. But what's nice is as these colors light up, you can get the indication of what's going on. So per se, a technician in the field can get information about this. There's other paper-based systems and origami methods where they actually fold these things together with different per se, like reagents and tabs, etc., and they can fold these materials together to make complex devices. So this is, in some senses, a lot simpler than what we used to do with, per se, thin film development using microelectronic techniques and top-down processing. This seems to be more rudimentary and simpler to do. So this is a move in the direction of cost reduction for applications for microfluidics. And a lot of this work is done by Whitesides. He's done a lot of this. We have some links in here that you're more than welcome to pursue. So paper-based devices, these are used for separation and detection of carbohydrates and amino acids, as we looked at before in our first example when we looked at the pulsed amphimeric detecting system. So he replicated that work via paper. You can take a look at that link. The advantage of these fluidic devices at large, just like the other devices, they're small, mobile, etc., but they take the place of lab-type devices, and they reduce jobs. But they make jobs for guys that make these devices, right? And these devices are more accessible, so hopefully the market goes up on those. So in summary, the microfluidics is an important emerging technology. We can analyze things like DNA, proteins, drugs, pollution. So they're used in a tremendous, innumerable amount of applications. But we have to take a look at fluidic flow, use that as boundary values, and then be able to engineer the materials around there. So certainly this is an intriguing application. A short discussion on this in our time frame that we have within this course period. Like I said before in the presentation, I've worked in this area and taken classes in this area. I think it's a really enjoyable area for an engineer to be involved in. So I'd like to thank you for your attention and look forward to talking to you about more topics in nanotechnology, and we'll see you the next time. Take care.